David Cobb is a college basketball and college football writer at CBS Sports, also a role player here at 92.9 ESPN, Monday, Wednesday, Friday with me, and then Thursday with Jeffrey Wright and company as the company on X at David W. Cobb. David, how's it going?
Hey, what's up, man? It's going well. I am sitting here working on my preseason win totals piece for next week. So that's always a fun one. Let me just say this real quick. Over the last three seasons in this piece, I am 11-2 with five pushes. So definitely something to pay attention to.
You want to preview anything in that piece? You just want it to? We'll talk about it Friday, maybe.
Well, it's still in the oven. It won't come out until next week.
Okay.
But I'm not just taking obscure teams, right? Like, I want to give the readers something interesting. I want to make the headline draw you in, right? So I'm not just going with lower tier like. Five win type of win totals here. I'm going with Auburn. I'm going with Notre Dame. I'm going with some teams that have a little star power in their brand. So it should be a good one.
Now we get the tournament going tomorrow here in Memphis. How about that? Who do you got? Who should I be looking for? No, you're a golf guy.
Yeah, I am. Give me Russell Henley. okay. Like, obviously Scotty's an overwhelming favorite.
And that's every week.
I get
though.
It. But like, he wants, like, if you're going to bet on golf, though, you don't want to just pick the favorite. That's kind of boring. The payoff on that is relatively insignificant. So you go Russell Henley at 30-1. My guy's got 9 top 10s this year. He's won this season. He was tied for 6th at Southwind a couple of years back. So, yeah, I think he could do well out there. You know, he's not a long player, but Southwind doesn't make you hit the ball super, super far. So I think he got a shot.
Yeah, what do you think about, like, the top players, you know, skipping out on the playoffs? Do we need more incentive to get these guys actually playing the entire playoffs? Because it's just it defeats the purpose of the playoffs when you have guys sitting out and just waiting.
Yeah, what it is we're lucky. Memphis is lucky that Rory McIlroy is the only premier player that is not playing this week. Of the guys in the top 70, I'm pretty sure he's the only one that's not here.
Right.
And that's remarkable because there's not really a lot of incentive for, let's say, the top 20 guys. You know, they're all safe. They're all safe for next week. They could take this week off and treat it like a bye if they wanted to. And if this is the way the PGA Tour wants to do it, where there's not going to be you're not going to start at the Tour Championship in Atlanta in a couple weeks at -8 or -10 or -5, depending on your spot in the standings. If they've done away with that, which they have,
yes,
then they need to be okay with the fact that some of the premier players are going to treat the first couple of weeks like it's a bye. Like it's like Gonzaga in the WCC tournament. They don't have to play until the semifinals because they had a good regular season. And if golf is okay with that being the case for their playoffs, then this format works great. But I would imagine they would prefer to have their top names participating in the playoffs, right? So, you know, it's definitely something they need to, you know, I think they did
talk about and address.
Like, this is the first, but like, this is the first year under the system. They changed the format for a reason. They thought it was unfair or uncompetitive or against the way golf should be to have guys go into the Tour Championship in Atlanta at -10 or -8. And I get it. That's your final event, and it's not as exciting if some teams start starting, you know, so far ahead of the field there. So they've nixed that, but in the process they've kind of handicapped or cut this week off at its knees and next week as well, for that matter. The BMW is gonna lose a little bit of luster if it doesn't mean as much going into the final week of the playoffs.
Not incentivized. Yeah. I mean, I get the decision they made, but it is what it is at this point. I also get why players are skipping out. All right, now getting to some college football. We may have crowned Julian Sain the starter for Ohio State a little bit too early. Looks like Ryan Day, head coach at Ohio State, says that there's a real battle going on between Julian Sain and Lincoln Kindholz, who was a 4-star in the 2023 class. He said the competition continues. They both have had good moments and moments where they're growing. I will say I've been pleased with the progress. It's going to go right down to the wire. The positives of having a competition is that you know every day you got to bring it. The guys are always on edge. They're uncomfortable. They're working at it. I think that's healthy for the entire building. What do you think, he's bluffing? What do you make of this?
Yeah, I think he's bluffing. I think Julian Sain's going to be the starting quarterback. I don't think Lincoln Keenholz is going to start against Texas. I don't believe that. So I think this is classic preseason camp coach speak. He's trying to light the competitive fire under Julian Sand. He's trying to keep Lincoln Keenholz playing at a high level in practice, trying to keep him engaged and trying to do the cultural thing, right, where it's competition. Every spot is for grabs. And I understand that, but at the same time, Julian Sand is in an Ohio State uniform for a reason. I mean, there's a reason he's there. He's there to be the starting quarterback. I think he's going to have every opportunity to be the starting quarterback, and I would be shocked if he is not the starting quarterback when they play Texas in week one.
You're a buyer in Julian Sand, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, for a guy that we haven't seen a whole lot from, yeah, I mean, he's got all the accolades. And it's about the system, too. It's about who you're surrounded by.
Yeah, correct.
You know, as we had that discussion about Dante Moore the other day, and it's like, all right, was he bad at UCLA because he's bad, or was he bad at UCLA because he was surrounded by a bad situation? It doesn't really matter who your quarterback is at Ohio State. He's going to be in a good situation. So I think either one of these guys could be really effective at quarterback for Ohio State. For crying out loud, you got Jeremiah Smith at wide receiver, not to mention about four or five other potential future NFL draft picks at wide receiver. So I'm a believer in Julian Sand, but more than that, I'm a believer in the team and in the program that he's going to be playing for.
Yeah. Now, one thing I don't think we've discussed enough is the running back room. I mean, they lost two NFL guys, and that was a big part of their offense last year with Will Howard. And that's one of the big reasons that they were able to get over top and win a natty under Ryan Day a year ago. Like, how confident are you that they'll get some good production? It's James Peeple, C.J. Donaldson, the transfer from West Virginia. How confident are you that they'll get some type of production to come close to matching what they had a year ago?
Yeah, they're not going to be as elite in that realm as they were last year. I mean, when it was all said and done, they had a couple of 1,000-yard rushers, Quinshon Judkins and Travion Henderson. I mean, that was a running back room that's on par with what Notre Dame has this year or what Penn State has this year with Nick Singleton and Catron Allen, right? They're not going to be that good in the run game again. In fact, across the board, Ohio State has a lot to replace, a lot of losses. I mean,
left tackle gone, Simmons.
Yeah, I mean, it's across in every position group, including wide receiver, because, yeah, I mean, they bring back Jeremiah Smith, but, Egbuka was, I think, actually their leading receiver in terms of receptions. Maybe not in terms of yards or touchdowns, but in terms of receptions, he was their top dog, and he's gone. So it's not, to me, a foregone conclusion that Ohio State's just going to waltz its way back into the semifinals of the college football playoff. It's not, to me, a foregone conclusion that they're going to finally get over the hump and beat Michigan. Now, I think their schedule is manageable enough between Texas and Michigan to where I feel pretty confident that they'll find a way to make the playoff. But lot of questions to answer there. I'm a believer.
Yep, I hear you. All right, now the CBS Sports 136 came out. It's you and your colleagues putting together your ballots. What would you change? This is what the top 10 was: Texas, Penn State, Ohio State, Clemson, Georgia, Notre Dame, Oregon, Alabama, LSU, Miami. I know that, you know, there's small changes. What changes did you have? How did you vote on this?
Yeah, I think that feels a little high for Miami to have them in the top 10. I think I'm around 13, maybe, on Miami. You know, you talked me into Penn State at one. I've got Penn State at one,
right,
Gabe. I owe that all to you. So
shout out.
If Penn State flops this year, I'm going to be
you can blame me. It's cool.
For that.
It's cool.
But no, I mean, I think in my ballot, I had, you know, a pretty similar variation of where we landed as a staff. I had Notre Dame 2. I had Texas 3. Ohio State 4, Georgia 5, LSU 6, and maybe I'm a little higher on LSU. I mean, I think LSU is a team with a really, really high ceiling this year. I know there was some concern today that, like, oh, did Garrett Nussmeier get hurt in practice? That seems to have been, you know, put to rest. But outside of an injury to Garrett Nussmeier, I mean, LSU should be – this should be the year, because you look around the SEC, the uncertainty with Georgia, with Gunnar Stockton – Alabama still trying to get up and rolling under Kalen DeBoer. You look at Texas with all that they lost and bringing in, you know, a new starter at quarterback. Granted, he should be a really good one, but my point is, like, if not now, then when for LSU? So I am cautiously optimistic that LSU at least makes the playoff and kind of figures it out this season.
If they don't make the playoff, what happens to Brian Kelly? Obviously, I still think they're like, their floor is probably 8 or 9 wins, right? So they'll have a decent season, at least on the surface. But, like, if Brian Kelly doesn't get through to the college football playoff, what happens to him?
Yeah, I think this might be it. I mean, you don't sink that level of resources into a guy only for him to not even, I mean, reach the standards of his predecessors. I mean,
right.
Les Miles and Ed Ogeron were able to win national titles at LSU. And you tell me Brian Kelly can't? That's problematic. I don't know if you've gotten into this Netflix series yet.
Not yet. I was going to start it tonight.
Yeah. I watched the first episode this morning. It's pretty good. It's pretty deep on LSU in the first episode. And I don't know, man. You watch him and his communication style in front of the team. I don't know if he's a great sort of locker room, stand in front of the team, vocal type of leader as a coach. I think he's a you know, really smart football mind. I think he's probably better in one-on-one situations, but like you compare and contrast the way he's able to get up and command a room with the way, I'll say it, Shane Beamer does, or a lot of these other coaches. I think that might be kind of where he's lacking, because this series is kind of pulling back the curtain a little bit and showing, you know, a little more behind the scenes than what we usually get from college football coaches, especially big time college football coaches like those in the SEC. And, you know, that was one of my first takeaways watching this thing. It's like, I don't know, man. Like, I'm listening to Brian Kelly and he's saying, hey, have joy, have fun out there. Well, like, you can say that all you want to, but it's actually on you to create a culture where that happens. You can't just tell people to go and have fun and enjoy it, right? Like, you know, and then you're lighting them up and you know, beating them down every other time you're on camera. Then you can't just get in front of them and say, have fun, loosen up. I mean, when everything you're saying and doing is kind of running contrary to that. Anyway, right. That's just some food for thought for you as you start the series.
All right. Now, I have one big issue with the CBS Sports 136. Do you care to take a guess? One huge issue. In the top 15.
Is Memphis?
It's in the top 15.
So it's not Memphis related.
Nope.
What is it?
Florida at 12? Florida at 12. I mean, DJ Lagler was awesome. They won 4 straight games to end the year last year, but he's been hurt most of camp. And it's unknown. Like, and it's a tough schedule at 12? That seems ridiculously high.
I mean, if you were power ranking it, I could understand that. If you're really projecting out what these teams are going to be, 12 is way too high for Florida. And I'll be honest, if we had to recast our ballots today, I think Florida would be in this ranking. I mean, we received our ballots for this a couple of weeks ago. And so most guys have been working on this for a while, especially those who do vote on all 136. It's a very exhaustive sort of exercise.
Of course.
And so, you know, you start on that before camp. You start on that in mid-July. And at the time, you don't know as much about DJ Lagway's injury situation. You don't know as much about how beat up their wide receiver room already is less than a week into camp. But now as those things sort of come to light, I think it does cast Florida in a little bit of a different light. And so I've got them at 18. I would probably stick with that. Even despite some of the injury issues that have come up. I agree. I think 12 is too high for Florida with the schedule they face. Even getting to 9 wins is going to be really, really challenging.
Mm-hmm. Now, where did you have Memphis? They came in at 56, but where did you have them?
Jeez. I didn't even realize they were that low. Now, I mean, I only voted on the top 30. Like, they let you pick.
Okay. Okay.
However many you want to vote on. And I've, for, you know, 5 years now, I've only done 30, man, because, you know, I tried the first couple of weeks back in 2021 or something to rank all 136. I mean, it takes hours. if you want to do it right, it takes a long, long time. So I capped it at 30. I do not have a single group of 5 team in my top 30. I considered Boise State. I considered Memphis. I considered Tulane. But my approach typically over the years with the G5 teams has been wait and see a month into the season which of them look good, which of them have maybe picked off a power conference team in the early going, and then sort of give them the nod as the season goes on. So I will eventually have multiple G5 teams in my top 30, but I rarely start with one in there.
But we didn't talk about this on Monday, but Memphis ended up getting votes in the coaches poll. Like, for you, like, there was on these airwaves, they got clowned for putting out a social media post and a graphic. It is what it is. I'm not saying I'm doing a victory lap, but to me, and I want to ask you this, to me, it feels like that's a hell of a compliment considering where this program was at one point. There's a benefit of the doubt that I feel like it's sort of Boise State and Memphis get in the group of six, right? Like that's the two teams every single year, even with new quarterback, new running back, new wide receivers, brand new defense, they're still getting votes from coaches around the country in the top 25.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of feels like Memphis has reached that point of, all right, we're just going to default to Memphis because of sustained excellence, very similar to Boise State in that way. I don't know if they should have put out a graphic or not, but I am amused by the fact that maybe you wanted to throw some hands, you know, at Brad for that tweet he put out.
Listen, it's social media department. They do what they do. If you get anything, it's a gift. You make a graphic and you throw it up there for parents, for recruiting, for all that. I didn't say the RV though, putting RV on there, just type out receiving votes.
Yeah, it's noteworthy. It's nice. Like, you're being recognized in some way, and that's good. But I'm surprised, man. Were you surprised that Memphis came in all the way down at 56 in our 136?
Not really. There's so much unknown about that team, David, as you know. I mean, it's so much that is just up in the air. Like, when I talk to Ryan, he barely knows what they're going to look like by the time they play Chattanooga at the end of the month. It's impossible to know with a full – they may have one returning starter on defense and I think three returning starters on offense, and that's it. Or no, two along the offensive line.
I like the late addition of the Nevada receiver. I mean, that's actually really helpful, a guy that probably has some chemistry with Brendan Lewis and a guy who caught 56 passes last year. You know, that's actually a big-time late addition.
Yeah, but I will spin that negative. I'm going to spin that negative for a second. It does show that they don't have a whole – they may not have a whole bunch of confidence in that pass-catching room, in that wide receiver room, if they're adding a guy that late. Now, listen, opportunities present themselves, and you take the opportunities. But that was another thing it did sort of show me, is they may not be as confident as they once thought in this wide receiver room.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm kind of optimistic, though, about the running back room. I mean, I think Sutton Smith is a guy that could be really good, you know, if he can stay healthy and stuff. And, you know, you just look across the board at, like, the rest of the American. And the rest of the American didn't do as good of a job in the portal, I don't think, as Memphis did. I mean, you could argue that Tulane is right there with Memphis, of course. And, you know, the thing that's interesting is that the service academies have such an advantage. And you know this because you talked about it on your G5 classified.
Yep.
Last season. If I'm not mistaken, you actually had one of the coaches on.
Yeah, I did.
But in this era, when most G5s are losing a lot of their top production to the portal at the end of every season, the service academies have a unique advantage because they have a totally different institutional mission than your typical football program does, which allows them to retain a lot of their top players. So Army and Navy, I think, have got to be a part of the conversation, not just in the American, but in the G5 in general, because you know, they bring back so many starters, and their systems are so unique, and you stay in those systems for 3 or 4 years, you really develop a fluency in it, and you're not second guessing yourself with every move that you make the first 3 or 4 games of the season. You're ready to go right out of the gate, and so those teams are really interesting to me. Again, I realize Army is going to have a much more difficult schedule this year than what they had a year ago, but I wouldn't sleep on Army and Navy.
Yeah, I wouldn't sleep on them either. We slept on them last year, and they showed us But the added layer to that is just the high school recruiting. And you sort of mentioned that, but like everybody else is hopping into the transfer portal. Not only is it continuity that they have, but they're getting better high school recruits than they ever have, because no one, it feels like everybody in the group of six is neglecting the high school recruiting because they have to, you know, year over year stay at a certain level. So they're getting better high school recruits than they ever have.
Yeah. And it was funny because 5 years ago, everybody was saying, oh, with this new redshirt rule, the service academies are at a disadvantage because you have to leave after 4 years. You know, you can't stick around and play 5 years with a redshirt, or 6 years with a redshirt and a medical redshirt, or 7 years with a COVID year, a medical redshirt and a redshirt. You know, and so they were like, oh, the service academies have it tough now because you only get 4 years with these guys when every other program you get five or six. And now it's kind of flipped, hasn't it? It's, oh, wow, the transfer rules in the NIL era have actually created a little bit of a niche and a little bit of an advantage for Army and Navy.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tennessee came in at 20 in the CBS Sports 136. Where did you have them? And listen, I know they're your alma mater. What is your take? Like, what is your overarching take about Tennessee heading into the season?
Yeah, I actually had them right at 20 as well. So I was identical to the consensus with Tennessee. I think they're going to be fine. Like, I think they're going to be a defensive-led team again. I don't think they added what they needed to add in the receiver room to really be considered a serious threat to have an elite sort of signature Josh Heupel offense. And there's a lot of factors there, among them the way defenses are really improving and figuring out how to defend that system. But I'll give Josh Heupel credit for this. He's recognized that. He's gone more run heavy, and he's also really, really emphasized retaining high-level defensive talent. Their defensive front is going to be among the best in the SEC again, and that's going to give them a pretty high floor, probably an 8-win type of floor for Tennessee. Don't think they're going to have the offensive pop needed to make it back to the college football playoff. 10-2 is maybe on the very upper end of what I could reasonably predict or project for Tennessee. I think 8, maybe 9, far more likely. But I think the program overall remains in really good shape. The recruiting class is coming together really, really well. And they're gonna have a focus or a real slant on retaining the young talent that's on the roster for the sake of building towards, I would say, 2027. I would circle 2027 as your year where Tennessee's gonna push in the chips and go all in and really look to make a national title type of push.
No, I know you just gave Heupel credit for pivoting last year and Dylan Sampson being the guy and being more run heavy. I never got the sense last year though that he wanted to do that. Like I don't know if he wants to pivot to be more run heavy. He just sort of had to.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, you look at Lane Kiffin and Ole Miss, who kind of run a similar system with the super wide splits. Like Jeff Lebby runs a similar system. I mean, there's a lot of coaches out there who are having to revamp and adjust because we've talked about it. It's those two high safeties. Defense is dropping 7 and dropping 8. And then on the rare occasions when, the opponent brings a blitz or goes heavy in the box, like you've got to have the speed at receiver and the quarterback who has the accuracy to make them pay for that by dropping in a deep ball. And Tennessee has not had that since Hendon Hooker was the quarterback. I mean, Joe Milton could not convert on the deep balls. Nico Iamaliava not only struggled to convert them, but was very reluctant to even take those shots last season. But I think part of that was orchestrated by Heupel, who's saying, look, Nico, we've got a great running game. We've got a great defense. We don't need you to be a hero. We can get everywhere we want to go this season by just making the smart, cautious play. Maybe that runs a little bit counter to Josh Heupel's, well, you know, what sort of made him pop onto the scene in first place as head coach at UCF, an offensive coordinator at Oklahoma and working at Missouri, right? Like it was a lot of the, throwing it 40 times a game and taking your deep shots. And that's certainly what worked for them at Tennessee in 2022. But that is not what's available right now when you run that offensive system. So you got to lean on what you're good at. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for leaning into his defense and leaning into his run game. And I fully expect more of that again this season.
Yep, we're getting close, though. Only a few more Saturdays, and we'll have some college football on the TV. But, David, appreciate it, man. We'll do it again on Friday.
All right, man. Sounds good.
He is David Cobb at David W. Cobb on X, college basketball, college football writer for CBS Sports. Now, we need to get into some NFL. Let's take a trip around the National Football League when we return right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM, ESPN. The Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM, ESPN. It's time to take a trip around the National Football League. Connor, hit it. Now, we were waiting for this all week, but the Chargers have brought back Keenan Allen. They're signing to a one-year deal. Keenan Allen in 11 seasons with the Chargers, 904 receptions, 10,530 yards, 59 touchdowns. He was an all-pro and a pro bowler. He has 26 receptions from 1,000 in his career. I hope this is a nice swan song for him. I know some people think he has completely lost it, whatever it is, but I still think he can really help out. He's familiar with Justin Herbert. He could get involved with that offense early and often. He's a target eater. And I expect good things from Keenan Allen. He still caught for 700 yards last year, and he got hurt along the way. There was a very big competition in that wide receiver room. You had Rome Odunze, DJ Moore with the Chicago Bears. I expect some good things from Keenan Allen. I like the signing for the Chargers. They needed help in that wide receiver room. I also think he can help along their young guys. Ladd McConkey had a really good rookie year. You have Trey Harris coming out from Ole Miss. I feel like Keenan Allen can really, really bring those young guys along. But love this signing. And what do we think about the Chargers this year? I'm not going to say they're for real, like I believe them. Believe in them to go win a Super Bowl by any stretch of the imagination, but I still think they can be plucky like they were last year and potentially get a wild card spot.
I totally agree. I think that's exactly what they're going to be. Their offensive line is for real and can be a difference maker. And if Justin Herbert has a good season.
That O-line, you're not lying. Joe Alt on one side and Rashawn Slater on the other. And Joe Alt, oh God, he is a mammoth man. I mean, he's huge. He's absolutely huge, and he's athletic as hell, too. He can play left or right. It's been fun to watch him sort of grow and develop in that Harbaugh system. First of all, Steelers rookie quarterback Will Howard banged his throwing hand in practice and suffered a fractured small bone in his hand. He's having additional tests, but it's likely no surgery is going to be required. He's expected to miss at least 3 weeks. More info's coming. It's not like he was going to break into that rotation anyway. They already have it figured out, Aaron Rodgers. And then he was probably going to be third string, fourth string, whatever it is. Maybe he'll end up on practice squad. We'll see. But I did want to bring this up. This was announced earlier this week, I believe on Monday. But the Steelers put out their first depth chart, and you know who was the wide receiver opposite of DK Metcalf?
Calvin Austin.
Calvin Austin III. That's awesome, man. That's awesome. And they must expect big things. He had a 500-yard receiving year last year with Russell Wilson. He could be a good deep threat for Aaron Rodgers if Aaron Rodgers still has that deep ball he can uncork. I think he's getting better with his route running across the middle. But, like, thinking back to what Calvin was when he first got to Memphis, he was a track runner. He's a track runner. I remember first day skills and drills. We go out there in the summer, and he's running slants, and just everything's bricking off his hands. He had to work his ass off to get a scholarship for football, got it, and then completely ran with it. I know that, like, the speed is the thing that he has really always had, but he didn't always have the hands or the route running to break into the NFL the way he has, and I expect big things from him this year. I mean, it's been a grind for him.
Could he be a sneaky top flex candidate in fantasy football this year?
Top flex? Let's relax about top flex. But
no,
I think,
being like your flex guy, not like number
being a bench flex guy. Yes, I think bench that. And there's certain matchups that you may like more than others. But I'd say wait till the late rounds. Wait till the late rounds, like right before you get a kicker or a defense. That's when
oh,
you would
he'll
take,
go. I think he'll
that's
go
when
before
you would
that.
Take Cal. I don't know.
When is our draft? By the way, what Ben Hogan? Where you at?
We haven't even. Line that up.
We got to line that up.
I was second last year and first in year one, so I'm coming back for the crown. I'm mad I didn't repeat. Jessica Benson handled business. Okay, so coming up on Friday, we know Shedeur Sanders is going to start for the Browns against the Panthers. They're doing joint practice right now. But we'll talk to Daniel Oyufusi here at 6 o'clock about Shedeur and the Browns in general. I don't think the Panthers are going to put their starters out there. But with the Panthers, are we not talking enough about Bryce Young going into year 3? Because something tells me we're not. This is a guy who, Obviously, his rookie year was ugly. Second year, for the most part, he was hurt. Then it was ugly. But at the end, week 16 to 18, 7 touchdowns, 612 yards, no interceptions. He had a 2-1 record with that Panthers team. Bryce Young has slowly but surely gotten to the point where he is a certified starter. Feels like the Panthers, all the reports I'm reading, there's just no question about it. And he's got some weapons to work with. He really does. So I feel like we're not talking about him enough. I don't expect big things from the Panthers, but Bryce Young could really show us something this year that he hasn't shown previously. Do you get that sense, Connor? Because I feel like we're not talking about this guy enough. He was a number one overall pick 3 years ago. I know it's been ugly to this point, but last year, at the end of the year, showed a lot of promise. And he's got Dave Canales at head coach, who really helped Baker Mayfield when he was with the Buccaneers as that reclamation project. I feel like Bryce Young's got it, and we're going to have to see. I know he's short. I know there's some things physically that people have issues with, but I feel like Bryce Young can have a good season.
He could. I think that people wrote him off because of how much he struggled at the beginning of last season, but he had a good end of year. So if you want to have a little bit of faith in Bryce Young because of how he closed the season, I don't hate it.
Yep. You know where I'm going with this? Did you see this?
I did see this. My favorite story of the day.
Vrabes is
other
hilarious.
Than Roman Anthony.
Mike Vrabel is hilarious. Like, he's got a player mindset. He goes after his players, but also loves on them to a certain extent. But today in practice, Mike Vrabel got caught in a scrum. Looked like the Patriots and Commanders were just going at it, just this big, massive brawl. And Mike Vrabel put himself directly in the middle of it. I don't know if he threw any punches. I haven't seen that reported. But he ended up coming out of that scrum with a bloodied cheek. And I don't think he'd have it any other way. I think he's totally happy with that. Makes him feel alive. Mike Vrabel, what a dog. What a damn dog. I do want to see, if somebody has video of this, I do want to see what Vrabel did when he actually got into the scrum. He's used to practice fights. He's talked about it. I think he was on Bustin' with the Boys a couple of weeks ago and talked about how he got in multiple fights his rookie year. Well, I forget where he was. He wasn't with the Patriots originally, but Vrabel is an absolute dog, man. Absolute dog.
It's just so funny. Do you think he threw any punches while he was in the pile in the scrum, or he was just trying to?
He was probably trying to pull guys out. Him throwing punches would look bad.
The idea of it, like, why did he jump into it? Like, you would think he'd be standing over and trying to pull guys off. He was like,
No,
let's go.
I feel like he lives for that type of stuff, man. I seriously do. I don't think he'd have it any other way. Now, no players were ejected. Like, Vrabel didn't hold anybody accountable. He just said, hey, it is what it is. Camp fights are so funny, though. One thing I have never understood, and I know it's hot, and everybody's sweaty, and they're frustrated, and it's, you get into the dog days there of training camp, and everyone just has a mood. You've been up, you haven't gotten enough sleep, you've lost a bunch of weight because of all the sweat that you've dropped off. But one thing I've never understood is like the lack of understanding and the lack of sort of logic when it comes to camp fights. Everybody's punching each other's helmets. You know what I mean? Like, everybody is punching each other in the helmet. You're going to hurt your hand. Why do you do that? But Mike Vrabel, do you think he threw a punch? Do you think he got in there through a punch, or he's just trying to grab people off?
I think the two details about it that are funny to me is, one, he dove into the pile to try to break up the fight. I'm not sure I've ever seen someone dive into a pile trying to break up a fight. Usually they're standing above it and trying to pull guys off of each other. And the second detail is that he got to the bottom of it, which means he must have been maneuvering in, like, if he's at the bottom of the pile.
Like, every other coach in the NFL just stands there when a fight happens and just crosses their arms.
Exactly.
Brian Schottenheimer had the Cowboys run after their scrum at practice the other day. Mike Vrabel's like, I'm going to get in on this.
This is what we live
for! Can't miss this! Can't miss this! Shout out, Vrabes. Bloody cheek and all. Now, Old Dominic. I need to tell you about Old Dominic. Get down to Old Dominic Distillery, 305 South Front Street is where you can find them. You could have a night on the town and just stop by and get a craft cocktail. I suggest that. They have specials coming up for Elvis Week if you're interested in that. But also, make sure you go to olddominic.com to book a tour and tasting at that state-of-the-art distillery. You're going to be able to try all of their wonderful spirits, gin, vodka, toddy, whiskey, bourbon. They have a brand new premium vodka that you can check out. They have award-winning selections of the whiskey and bourbon, and they have multiple selections. So just go to your local liquor store, find a bottle, and go with it. I mean, they have a phenomenal, phenomenal selection. It's the most fresh, most full spirit you can buy in the city because the distillery is in town. And we have that Memphis Aquifer water, some of the best water in the country. Always remember, you can ship Old Dominic Spirits anywhere in the United States of America. We have a lot of extended family members that don't get to get their hands on a bottle of Old Dominic. So make sure you allow them to get their hands on a bottle of Old Dominic by going to olddominic.com and sending it off. Also, check out their schedule. They have music every single weekend, just about through August. They're planning things for September. Make sure you go and look at their schedule. And they will have a watch party for Chattanooga in Memphis coming up on the 30th. Get to olddominic.com, Old Dominic Distillery. Come say hi. All right, we need to wrap up hour number two. We'll go ahead and get to Small Talk when we return right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. And Small Talk is brought to you by Conway Services, reputable service available 7 days a week. Now, I have not gotten to watch. Other things popped up last night, but episode one of Hard Knocks. Connor, let me know. What do I need to look for when I watch it tonight?
It was exactly what we thought it was going to be. It opens on Josh Allen and how much of a talent he is, how much of a leader he is. It talks about Trey White returning to the Bills and his journey. And literally every single player that we named yesterday and that Jeff named
Deion Dawkins
was highlighted. And Deion Dawkins is a drifter. Like Tokyo Drift, like he goes and drives drift cars almost every single day. He was like, I do this daily. And I was like,
they didn't write that into the contract. Like, don't do that.
Do the Bills know that? So I thought that was pretty funny. But overall, it was an okay episode of Hard Knocks. It's just with the behind the scenes stuff, when we are desperately looking for any football right now as we're getting closer, it was able to scratch that itch for me for the most part. I will say, though, Hard Knocks just feels like it has become more of a infomercial for these teams than the journey in camp. And, you know, I think that the last few years we've seen it kind of go more star heavy. It focuses on some of the star players a little bit more. Damar Hamlin was in it at the beginning. They actually didn't mention what he's been through. The Kansas City Chiefs were mentioned, I think, twice. They showed the footage of them losing in the game last year. But they didn't introduce us to any guys trying to make the team.
Which I hate.
There was no mention of someone trying to make the team. We were introduced to a couple of the rookies, but it was mostly veteran players that you know are going to be on the team. And there wasn't any drama there. That's why I'm not connected necessarily to any of the players, because I already knew these players. We already know about them for the most part. So I think it was an okay episode of Hard Knocks overall. It was fun just seeing football back. It was fun seeing the Bills in the community. They have a tremendous fan base.
Yep.
All of the players seem very gracious to be there. The coaching staff seems very nice. I just don't know if we're going to get the behind-the-scenes stuff.
Are we ever going to get back to that?
I don't know. And that's where, you know, I'm trying not to judge it too much, because it is just the first episode. And its job is to introduce you to the team, to introduce you to some of the stars. I just wish we were getting the journey of some of the players trying to make the team.
Right.
Now, that being said, it is only the first episode. Maybe that's going to happen in episode 2, 3, or 4. Like, there are more episodes to come. Maybe they will introduce us to those players as time goes on, and they just wanted to front load it with the players that you know to try to get you hooked into the season. Because the Josh Allen stuff was interesting. They showed you, they did a stadium tour of the new one that's coming up next season, and it looks incredible. They talked about some of the engineering that goes into it. The owner had a great line about when you have people that you trust in positions, you don't have to micromanage, which, to be honest, was very funny with all the conversations we've had about somebody like, I don't know, Jerry Jones as recent, because it's the first time I've ever heard the Bills owner speak. So, you know, I just thought that was kind of a funny thing to have going on. But I thought, you know, it was a good episode, and people are going to, I think, fall in love with a guy like Trey White because of his story and how hard he works. There's just not too much to really say about it. It's just a different Hard Knocks than it used to be. Yep. It has changed over time, and I'm not sure we're ever going to get the early versions of Hard Knocks again, that real grit to it. It was lighthearted. It was wholesome. And, you know, some people don't really want that from Hard Knocks. They want the grittiness. They want the drama. They want the stories of these guys trying to make the team. And I tend to lean that way, but for a football documentary about a training camp, it was pretty good.
I'm hearing some good things about the SEC documentary, though, on Netflix.
I've heard great things.
Yeah, so hopefully you can get something out of that. But I miss the human interest stories of the undrafted free agents.
You see really what Pavia said?
What did he say?
He said that they can beat Tennessee on any given Saturday. It's like, all right.
All right, but the undrafted free agent stuff and seeing guys get cut and you know what happens off the field, like I miss that part of it.
The biggest thing that I took away was where they are having training camp is gorgeous.
Yeah.
It, like Rochester, it looked amazing. And Josh Allen is like a god to those players. There was one of the rookies that said that he accidentally picked up Josh Allen's towel and wiped his face with it. And he was like, maybe I could have gotten Josh Allen's sweat on me. It's like, what is going on
That's
here?
Gross.
They look at him as a god and as a leader. And he carried himself very well through the episode. That was the biggest takeaway for me.
Did they show his wedding?
No, they discussed it right at the beginning. At the very beginning, somebody said congratulations on the wedding, and he said thank you. And then some interviewer was like, I'm getting married too. And he was like, great. Like, Josh Allen came off as a very humble superstar, down to earth, but people follow him.
Yeah.
Like, that was the biggest takeaway. And even the coaches were like, we watched this kid become a man, and now he's arguably the best player in the NFL. And
he's
MVP. It was cool. That was a really cool part of the show, was seeing how much they hold Josh Allen up on a pedestal.
Yeah, that's what we do. I mean, it was Paxton and Riley, when I was at the University of Memphis, you watch film, and you're just like, how do these guys do what they do? I mean, that's what happens within a locker room when you have somebody play that damn well. Now, hour number three is on the way, and we have some Cleveland Browns and Shedeur Sanders to talk about. We'll bring on ESPN Browns reporter Daniel Oyefusi next, right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.